All right, welcome back. Haven't done an episode in a long time. Joined by a Twitter friend of mine, David. He runs College Golf Book on Twitter. Today we're going to talk a lot about intercollegiate golf history, something that I am very interested in but not super well versed in. David is. So this is going to be a very in-depth, I think, detailed episode. David, thank you for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Cannon. Man, I really appreciate you having me on. I've enjoyed all of your podcasts and stuff, so it's great to be here and join you.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Go ahead and shout out your Twitter page so people can follow you. I love your Twitter. All of your stuff is great. It's been a great follow. So tell the people where they can find you on Twitter.
Awesome, man. No, I appreciate you saying that. So my Twitter handle is cgolfbook. It's College Golf Book is what I go by, but that's already taken, so I had to shorten it a bit. I'm on there quite a bit. Also recently started up a Substack. So that's 5count4. Those are the numbers 5 and 4. .substack.com, and that's where I've been kind of putting together a lot of notes, trying to go through and do some hopefully interesting posts on college golf history.
Yeah, your Twitter's great, man. I really do enjoy all of that. I probably sound terrible right now. I'm a little sick, so for anybody listening, I'm sorry if I'm miserable to listen to, but we'll just go ahead and get into it. We were talking before, you were saying I just competed last year, the 125th NCAA championship. It's been going on for a long time now, but the history of NCAA golf isn't honestly as old as I thought it would be with how old golf is in general. So I think you kind of want to start at the beginning. I want to start at the beginning. So what I see on this page is 1897, and we'll just start from there. How's that sound?
No, it sounds good. You know, really, it's quite interesting because golf here in the United States is not as old as, you know, elsewhere. It was brought over here in the late 1800s. And, you know, that's not something that I'm super well versed in. There are a lot of actual golf historians that could tell you more about that founding. But it is interesting whenever you think about the fact that the USGA got started in 1895. Right. And so you've got some of the oldest golf clubs that were founded in the late 1880s. They got together and you've got the Country Club of Brookline, St. Andrews Golf Club, Shinnecock Hills, Chicago Golf Club, and Newport Country Club are the first five that started that. And if you want to think of, you know, just the general timeline as far as the beginning of both golf and college golf, you think about the fact that the very first time that we start hearing about golf being, you know, this new fangled thing that we were doing, this latest sports fad in the United States, was 1893. And if you were to think about that in terms of maybe your senior year of high school, you start thinking about, all right, well, there's this new thing called golf where you've got these guys running around a field using sticks to hit a ball into a hole, right? So by your freshman year of college, there's all of a sudden this new thing called a U.S. Amateur and the U.S. Open. And then your sophomore year, you've got the USGA that's gotten together. These clubs are deciding that they're going to do stuff officially. Your junior year of college, all of a sudden you hear about a few colleges that are getting together and starting to play. And then by your senior year, you've got the first college golf championship. So that kind of runs you through 1894 to 1897. And you know, really that's where everything kind of jumps off.
Yeah. So I want to get actually more into that a little bit. That's fascinating to me. Cause I never knew the USGA was started like that in that form, I guess, in that capacity. So you talk about 1894, 1895, the US Open and US Amateur is created, correct?
Yes.
So first year US Am is 1894 and then college golf starts basically after the creation of those two events.
Yeah, essentially. So it's kind of funny. There's a little bit of a controversy over whether the USGA formally recognizes the 1894 championships. We'll say that they were actually official. And 1895, when the USGA got started, you have the first USGA version of those things, but it kind of takes off from there. So some of the main characters that you hear about with the USGA, with the founding of golf at that time, Theodore Havemeyer, which is a name that most people know, if for no other reason than because of the Havemeyer Trophy. He was the very first president, and he actually had a direct connection with college golf getting started because his sons, Henry and Frederick, excuse me, were playing for Yale. They actually were a part of that Yale Golf Club getting started. Another guy is John Reed. He is the founder of St. Andrews Golf Club, and he's considered the father of American golf. Well, his son, John Reed Jr., played for Yale at the same time. He and the Havermeyers and a third guy by the name of Roderick Terry. Roderick Terry Jr. specifically is the one. Those guys kind of got the Yale Golf Club started up in 1896. So you've got a lot of connections between the USGA, which got everything started on, let's say, all levels, amateur and pro, just with their tournaments that they're starting out. And then you've also got those connections to the founding of college golf as well.
Yeah, so it sounded like Yale had all the big players at the time, all the big pushers. No, that's actually fascinating though that you said Yale, because like in college golf for me, like there was a regional I think 2 years ago at Yale's place. I kind of wanted to be in that regional just to see Yale Golf Club.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't really know much about it other than that it's old and it has like one really cool par three. So I guess like that golf course was founded in 1896, you said?
Yeah, thereabouts. It's actually 1895, 96 is when you've got the founding of Yale Golf there. And it started out with being a bunch of the professors and local people. It wasn't specifically college students. The college students started their offshoot in 1896, the Yale Golf Club. So it gets a little convoluted there with the distinction, but yeah, so it actually started up right around that time.
So I guess my next question would be, is the Yales and the Harvards, were they the heavy hitters in college golf when it first started? Like, was it Ivy League and then other institutions started picking up the game as more time went along? Or what did that look like in the very early days of like college golf?
Essentially, yeah, what you said, it's funny, we've got 125 playings of this championship. 41 of them took place before the NCAA took over the championship. So you've got a full third of college golf history that was kind of recorded, if you will, before the NCAA becomes involved. So I don't know about you. For me personally, whenever I got started looking at this last couple of years, it was I had this misconception that, maybe it was just the Ivy Leagues were kind of up there doing their own thing. And then the NCAA got involved and maybe that opened up to a wider audience and kind of went from there. But truthfully, what we see the ability for the students who were at those institutions. I mean, they had the resources, they had the connections to kind of get started their own golf clubs the earliest. And as we see that kind of pick up with other universities as time goes on, you do see those universities kind of brought in and get their opportunity to perform on the national stage, if you will. It was a closed shop for a while, but it really wasn't as closed as at least I had the misconception of whenever I first got started looking at this.
Yeah, no, that's wild. So I have here in the notes, the first college golf match was October 1896. Yale played St. Andrews. Are we talking about a St. Andrews here in America, or are we talking about the overseas St. Andrews? And that might be a crazy dumb question, but I just had to ask it.
No, that's not dumb at all. No, it's very intentionally named. So that is a St. Andrews Golf Club that's here in the United States, specifically Hastings on the Hudson in New York. So, we're talking about an area that's what, about an hour's drive away from New York City.
Okay.
So it's founded by a transplant from Scotland, and we're talking about folks that have that direct connection over to the old course in St. Andrews. So that's where you get the naming very intentionally of St. Andrews. And that first golf match that you mentioned for college golfers is a 10 on 10 match. It was representatives from the St. Andrews Club, including John Reed Sr., the guy who started it, and his son on the other side with the Yale Golf Club. So you have a 10-on-10 match, basically. That's one of the oldest, if not the very first match of a actual college golf team.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah, it is.
So St. Andrews, the club you're talking about in New York, I assume that's where
yes.
in New York. Okay, so it is now the current home of Columbia, is that correct?
Yes.
So are we still seeing, like, I'm not super well versed in the whole Ivy League whole thing. Is Columbia and Yale and Princeton and Harvard, are they still playing matches like this up at St. Andrews, or what is that like at Yale? Are these golf courses still being like utilized very heavily by these teams, or is this just like back in the past?
I would say it's more back in the past. There are definitely certain types of things, certain types of matches that are happening on occasion. I mean, ceremonial matches, if you will. Obviously, the Ivy League championships are still going on. That is still very much a thing. But let's kind of point at one specific instance. So 2021, October 2021, is when you had the 125th anniversary of this first match between actual college golf teams. And that ceremonial 125th playing was reproduced. You've got the two teams that played against each other. So that's going to be Yale and Columbia that had kind of a rematch. They used the same kind of format. They played there at St. Andrews, whereas the very first playing was actually just a little bit up the road at another place called Ardsley. Which we can get into all that now if that's what you want to do. But essentially, to answer your question, I think by and large, it's more for special occasions for those types of courses. Just they're very, you know, prestigious. They've got a lot of other things going on. They're not exactly hosting a lot of college golf matches.
Absolutely.
At least that's my understanding.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Because, I mean, like, we don't see Ivy Leagues very much. Like, we played – up in New York this year at Maidstone, saw a couple of them, but I mean, that was the first time I've seen Princeton and Yale, I think, since I've been in school. So it was fascinating to play with them, and they're all really great players, but this sounds really, really cool. Let's get into the IGA stuff. And then Ardsley as well. I want to talk about that. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really is. So, I'll back up for just a second and point out the other sports at the time are not exactly run using national bodies the way we would think of like the NCAA now, right? So it's a lot more driven by the players themselves, by representatives of the college, which was taken on mostly by the captains of those teams. So, you know, football, baseball, these types of things weren't run by national institutions that kind of oversaw everything. So with that in mind, we get into the first playing of any kind of like college golf event, which again, October 1896 is when you've got the clubs first getting started out. One of the Yale players, Roderick Terry Jr., his father, who has two honorifics, Reverend and Doctor. I'm going to call him Reverend for short, but Reverend Terry was the tournament committee, if you will, for Ardsley, which is just up the road from St. Andrews in New York. So same general area. And he had a real affinity for, you know, his son, his team kind of getting started and getting a chance to play. So he took the initiative of sending out invitations to five universities to try and get some kind of college golf thing going. So he sent it out to Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, and Penn. So you've got Reverend Terry, who's kind of leading the charge, just saying, hey, we have a venue. If you guys want to come and play, let's get everybody together and playing in early November. It's a fairly short time frame to try and get everything started. Yale obviously had a team going. Columbia was able to get some players together to join up, but the other institutions really couldn't get anything going that quickly. Harvard and Penn specifically had a hard time putting together a team. that quickly. Princeton did have a team that was getting started, but the Princeton Harvard football game was happening at the same time, and so the Princeton players decided not to actually show up.
Oh, wow.
So I can imagine that is not an issue for you guys today, although with some certain football games going on, I know you guys have had to watch some of the football games after matches, so I imagine that that's somewhat tempting.
Yeah, I think 125 years have passed, so the head coach has figured out how to schedule golf tournaments around home games.
Yeah.
So that helps out a little bit. But so I see, so Ardsley was the first host, correct, of the first tournament. And then we
Correct.
move kind of after that into Garden City, another New York golf course. This is 1905 at this point, 1906. One thing you had on your notes was the next time there was a championship, NCAA championship. I'm calling it NCAA championship at this point.
That's fair.
But so they have the NCAA championship, air quotes, 1905, 1906, Garden City. Next time it's repeated at a golf course is when it's hosted by Greyhawk, 2021, 2023. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, so Ardsley had and Reverend Terry specifically had very graciously offered up the course for use. What they decided to do was offer a very nice trophy called the Ardsley Cup. It cost the club $250, which in today's money is north of $8,000. So very nice trophy, very nice awards. They signed up for a contract, if you will, of saying we'll host the first three championship playings, and then at that point you guys can move on to other courses if you want to. So the first three playings were at Ardsley, and then it started moving around. As you alluded to, there was another section there where back-to-back championships were hosted at the same location, but then it wasn't again until Greyhawk that you get this the same venue hosting it multiple years in a row. They went back to the same courses a couple of different times, but just in a row like that didn't happen very often.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like that was a weird stat for me to read because I feel like they've had it at Carson Creek a thousand times. So
Yeah,
I
I
see
mean,
it.
like I said, they've definitely had it repeated at other courses, just doing it back to back like that in consecutive years.
Absolutely, yeah. So I guess we'll kind of move forward a little bit, unless you want to touch on anything else during this time period that you think is really interesting.
Well, I mean, if you don't mind, I do want to just kind of close the door on the Ardsley Cup thing, if you will.
Absolutely.
So, one of the popular things to do at that time is when you're offering up a championship of some, or excuse me, a trophy of some kind, putting conditions on it so that a team or individual or whatever that wins it a certain number of times, let's say three times, which is the case with Ardsley Cup, then that institution gets to keep it. So, first two championships were won by Yale. The last championship that Ardsley was hosting was also the opportunity for Yale to get to keep it. It didn't work out that way for him. It actually ended up going to extra holes. They had an extra match that they had to do to determine who between Yale and Harvard was going to win that one. Harvard came out on top. They ended up winning the next two championships after that, which it ended up allowing them to be able to keep the cup. So Harvard gets the Ardsley Cup. They bring it back to their trophy room, and it goes somewhere. It kind of disappeared for quite a long time. And it wasn't until recently, actually, that we got confirmation that they do still have that trophy. So I think Harvard is kind of putting together some different things with that. And to kind of showcase the fact that they have the very first college championship trophy in their trophy case, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad you went back to that because I saw that on your Twitter, and that's actually what made me want to do this podcast. So I'm very glad you brought that back up. That is crazy that it's just sitting there and no one really thought about it for 100 years, and now we're bringing it back out. That's awesome. So I guess moving forward after that, we kind of start running into like Western Golf Association. It seems like more organized golf after that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, so I kind of touched on the, or you kind of touched on the IGA, who was running college golf, and that is a representative, a couple of different representatives from the schools that are actually members of this. So you've got Harvard, Yale, Penn, Princeton, Columbia, and then a couple of other universities kind of join on after that, but it's still representatives from those universities kind of dictating, membership and who's going to show up for some of these championships. So what we see is Chick Evans is a name that I don't know that it's fair to say most, but a lot of people who have studied any amount of golf history might recognize he was kind of the Bobby Jones before Bobby Jones was a thing. He was about 10 years older. Chick Evans was from the Illinois Chicago area, and he got really big into the Western Golf Association championships that they were running. That your Big Ten country, if you will, is was considered Western at the time, and he thought he would be able to compete as an individual in 1910 for this college golf championship, but he wasn't able to. And he had kind of spearheaded a attempt at having a Western IGA, so a WIGA. That kind of tried to take off. It didn't really, but you had teams like Chicago, Illinois, Wisconsin, Northwestern, Michigan. The teams that we think of as Big Ten teams were trying to get that started up before World War I and trying to organize their own thing. It didn't really take off like that until after World War I, whenever you start seeing some conference golf being played. But yeah, it's organized in a couple of different places at that point.
Yeah, and it seems like it happens fast. Like, and that was the only reason I kind of skipped ahead a little bit was like, you get, I mean, you can always correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like around 1905, 1906, WGA is founded, starts playing really like competitive golf, like you said. And then you get 1913, 1914, 1915, all big Western Golf Association events, I assume, hosted in Chicago. And then just like more really good golf, it seems like. And it feels like from this point on, everything started to snowball into like really, really organized golf. And you had some really cool facts in here. In 1914, Yale was on a revenge tour as their streak of championships had ended in 1914 after nine straight. They ran into Princeton. They became the first to outside of Yale or Harvard win a title. And your last note on that was it just so happens that that year is the only year that Prescott Bush played for Yale. Prescott Bush was the future USGA president, father to US president, and grandfather to another. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. That was a interesting thing to kind of stumble across. It had been mentioned in a couple of different places, but I certainly wasn't something that I was aware of. I know the Bushes had played other sports like baseball, but yeah, I didn't know that Prescott Bush had actually played on the Yale golf team. And it just so happens the only year that it looks like he competed in the championship was the year that they broke their streak. So that's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, that's crazy. Around that same time, though, it looks like you have Illinois being thrown into the mix. Is this the University of Illinois that we're talking about, or is
It is.
this? It is.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
So Illinois and Chicago, who was an early member of the Big Ten Conference, those were two teams that were really starting to play more golf, actually having teams organized and playing against each other. So it's kind of interesting that Illinois had some connections to allow them to try and reach out. They applied for membership into the IGA, were granted it. And right before the start of World War I, which is where it kind of closed down for a couple of years, you see Illinois make an appearance as the first quote unquote Western team. But if you'll allow me an indulgence, there's actually I've been able to find so far, the first golf transfer specifically for golf seems to have been Joe McDonald, who was a member of the University of Chicago. And Chicago was not a program that had reached out to try and join the IGA. They were content with staying and playing in that region, but Illinois was. So you've got Joe McDonald transfers to Illinois so that he can join the team and play in the 1916 championship. And he actually filled the vacancy from Illinois' captain from the previous year, Howard Walton, who himself transferred to Penn. That seems to be an academic transfer, not a golf transfer. But Walton became the first player to play for two different teams in the championship. And the vacancy that he left at Illinois was filled by a transfer from Chicago, who then got to play in the 1916 championship.
Yeah, that's crazy. You cut out a little bit, so I just want to go back over that. Joe McDonald, one of Chicago's best players, transfers to Illinois, fills the vacancy of Howard Walton, who was at Illinois and transferred to Penn for academic reasons more so than golf, correct?
Correct.
Okay. That's what I thought we were talking about. Sorry, it just kind of cut out. My Wi-Fi might be bad, but yeah, no, that's crazy. That's really cool. Really cool. So yeah, from there, we start going. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, from there, you have Illinois competing in the championship. That one was actually hosted by Oakmont, which I know you have some familiarity with. And, you know, that was a really cool championship. They start trying to do venues that are more Western, again, air quotes. And then you've got World War One that happens and puts a halt to everything. There's no USGA or college golf championships for the next 2 years. But when you get to the other side of World War One, things start really taking off. We think of college golf kind of exploding after World War II, which it does. But the first real ramp up that you get is after World War One.
Yeah. That's all right. So this is where I can, the first 30 minutes of this might be a tough listen because I have no clue what I'm talking about when we're talking about 1905, but I think I might be able to catch up a little bit after World War One. It seems like we have legit sponsored golf events with institutions that people might be able to relate to a little bit more. And then, like you said, obviously after World War Two, it really takes off, but what was the difference after World War One than before World War One, and why did these teams start playing golf more, and who was kind of in the mix at this time post World War One?
Yeah, so as to the why, I mean, it seems like just from what's been reported in, you know, various newspapers at that time, and you know, things that were kind of written down and really kind of expounded upon, that we can, you know, say more for sure what was going on. You start having more people that have been exposed to the game all across the country who have the means to be able to play. You know, we're still not talking about a very cheap game, clubs and balls and all that, but you start really getting into a greater pool of players that are coming up across the entire nation. You've got the state sponsored golf tournaments that are popping up everywhere. You've got more and more universities that are willing to allow clubs and different things to get going. So the biggest thing that we're going to see really post World War One is the conferences themselves, which are, you know, universities kind of got together for sports like football. That's kind of always been the driving force. But you've got the Big Ten, you've got the start of the various Southern Conference, which itself broke off a couple of different times. And you've got the SEC that came out of that in the 1930s, and then you've got the ACC that came out of that in the 1950s. So that conference was pretty huge and allowed for a lot of different things. But really, I would say probably the Big Ten schools are the ones that most people could relate to. You've got Big Ten golf that starts in 1920. For the first 2 years, it was open to non-Big Ten schools. And we saw the University of Drake, which is maybe a smaller school that people aren't as familiar with, but they're from Iowa. They came in and won the first two, and I think it seemed to be the reason why Big Ten closed it off and became only Big Ten event after that. So, again, University of Chicago is still in the mix at that time, but you've got Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Northwestern, Purdue, Ohio State, Minnesota, Indiana, and Iowa are kind of your teams there.
Yeah. Shout out to Drake University, University of Drake, whatever it is. They had a great basketball team a couple of years ago, probably like 10 or 12 years ago. I remember them playing in the NCAA March Madness. That's the really only thing I know about Drake, other than now this. So
Well, they had a good basketball team back then too. Ted Payzer is a name that you might have some people's ears perk up at, but that he became really well known later on whenever he was the coach and then AD for Northwestern, and he played a huge role in the golf not only there at Northwestern but also when it really started taking off with the NCAA. He was a huge not only supporter of, but he was very, very much involved in the early decisions and different things. So Ted Payzer is a name that more people should know about because he's got a great history once he started coaching. But even before that, he was on that Drake golf team that kind of led the charge with both the first Big Ten championships and then also the Missouri Valley Conference.
dual sport athlete, man.
Yeah, man.
Killer. That's awesome. So we start seeing, like, obviously, like you said, more conference champions, conference tournaments. Was there the, I guess, was it like conference champions were getting automatic invites into like IGA tournaments now or Western Golf Association tournaments, or like who was still running this, and like was there and quote unquote NCAA trying to take control of all of this, or was it more so the conferences at this point trying to piece together teams and play tournaments against each other?
That's a good question. So the IGA is still running things. They start getting more and more closely associated with the USGA to the point where in 1930, the USGA kind of takes over running of the championship. It folds in with the rest of the championships that they're running. But it was still meant to be the IGA, the student-led organization that's, in charge of membership and things like that. The NCAA, the first mention that I've been able to find of anyone in the NCAA seriously considering running a golf championship was in 1935. And then they eventually picked it up in 1939 from the USGA and the IGA. But it's still the IGA that's running things, if you will. USGA is kind of your overseeing entity, but the IGA, the students themselves, are the ones who are kind of in charge of that. And what they do is you start seeing more deals, maybe isn't the right word, but you start seeing more individuals and teams that are getting invited up to play in the tournament, even though they're not IGA members. For example, you've got the early start of the Southern Conference. They start their own Southern IGA, and one of the earliest winners of that is actually Alabama, and their individual champion, Bobby Baugh, was invited to come play in that tournament just as an individual. And then also a name that people might recognize from the record books, George Lamprecht. He's from Tulane. That's how he was able to get into those championships as well. The national championship was the fact that he's playing for these Southern Intercollegiate Championships. Won a few, lost a few, but the winner and runner-up were generally invited to play for the national championship. And then Lamprecht was able to really show out, and he won back-to-back titles in 1925 and 1926 as an individual.
Yeah, some things never change. Lamprecht's being good at golf.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, dude, that kid's so good. All right, so you have in your notes here, it all changes with Michigan. This is a little jump
Yes.
ahead, 1930. We were just talking about World War I. Let's talk about Michigan for a sec, because it seems like
Yes.
they really did change the course of college golf.
They did, and I'm so glad you mentioned this because Michigan should get the shout out for being a blue blood golf team. They really ran the show in the 30s, and largely are a reason why things kind of got opened up the way that they did. They had a coach by the name of Trueblood, Dr. Trueblood, which is just an awesome name. He had started up their program in 1902. And he retired in 1936, but along the way, he ended up piecing together an incredible record. So his teams won 54 of 64 Big Ten dual matches, and he had a total record of 54, 8-2, which is just awesome. And then starting with 1932 through 1936, they had an incredible run. They had five straight Big Ten championships. They had two different individual winners for the national championship. And then in 1934 is when they, really busted everything open by winning the team championship. They were the first, again, air quotes, but Western team to take that championship away. And then they came back and repeated in 1935, much to the chagrin of the other teams that were there. But Michigan winning not just once but twice really opened things up at that point. Now, if you're looking at the record book, you're seeing individuals from all over the place that are coming away with the individual title as well. I mean, you're seeing your Oklahoma, Georgetown. You've got well, we mentioned Tulane already, but Texas, LSU with Fred Haas Jr. You're starting to see it really become a more national championship. And within the next couple of years, you've got Stanford's that are entering the mix and go on their own run. And then you see the NCAA come in and take over the championship.
So you have Michigan win in 35, and then Yale and Princeton win in 36 and 37. And then, like you said, Stanford, it looks like, comes into the mix. And it looks like kind of the whole west side of the United States starts getting into the whole college golf scene. So that's
For
fascinating.
sure, yeah.
Michigan. I'll call them a blue blood. I'll call them a blue blood.
They are indeed. They deserve that title.
Yeah. So, like you said, the NCAA started hosting championships in 1920. The first suggestion to conduct a golf championship was in 35. It would take what, 4 more years for them to actually host the championship?
That's correct. Yeah, 1939 is when they hosted the first one. And really, I mean, we think of the 1939 as being a hard line in the sand as far as going from, what was before. And then all of a sudden it's the NCAA and we're talking about official things. But really, it was just a continuation. 1938 to 1939, there wasn't a huge difference in terms of what was done. It was just a lot more fanfare. So you've got the NCAA that brings, structure, and they definitely had their structured guidance on everything. But by and large, I mean, you don't see a whole lot of difference between Stanford winning in 1938 and Stanford winning again in 1939.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
Yeah.
so it seems
Now,
like they added some stability and I guess some places to play.
they did. Yeah. So Chick Evans, I had mentioned, he's the chairman of the first NCAA committee. And you've got a bunch of names on there with him that are representatives throughout college golf. You've got Jeff Sweetser, who is your USGA treasurer at the time. He was a real big deal, had won a championship back in the 1920s himself. But you've got LSU that's represented there with Paul Leslie, James Hogan, the Pitt athletic director. Wooster coach, Elsie Bowles, Eddie Twiggs, who's the Stanford coach. He's a huge deal. His team won back-to-back championships there. Ted Payzer, I'd mentioned, the Northwestern coach at the time. And then Sid Richardson, who played for him, was the current IGA president. So the IGA got a representative seat on this NCAA committee and did all the way through World War II, where they kind of just faded out.
Yeah. So, all right, let's go back. 1939, they host their first championship. It goes well. 1940, it's kind of a shit show. What happened? What's going on? Why is this happening? And what is the overall rundown as to what happened in 1940?
Yeah. So, I'd hate to talk bad about it too much just because, it was a good championship. It's more the behind the scenes things that's going on, and it's actually super important going forward. So, 1939 championship, like you said, everything goes well. Everybody's patting each other on the back. We've done some good here. We've got a good thing going. So, the 1940 championship is expected to be, a continuation of the same. Hartford Golf Course, Hartford, this is in Connecticut, had originally been promised the championship, and then all of a sudden, Aquonic Country Club, I know I'm butchering that, but they're up in Vermont. They had hosted a championship early before World War One, 1912 specifically is when they did, but they've got a real enigmatic guy by the name of Bartlett Arkell. He was the CEO of a company called Beechnut. And he's real well known for using his money for a lot of different things. I mean, he was a philanthropist for sure, but he did a lot of things for his club, that country club there. Well, what we know from something that was actually published in the newspaper, this is how mad they were about it. Hartford was promised the hosting of the 1940 championship. And then all of a sudden, Chick Evans, who is the NCAA chairman, for golf specifically, came back and asked for $2,000 above and beyond what you get for like selling tickets and stuff like that. And Hartford said, "Well, no, we're not going to do that." And so all of a sudden,
Double it.
you get this announcement that another course is going to take it. And what we find out from there is that Bartlett Arkell had offered a very, very nice trophy that was called the Chick Evans Bowl. It was somewhere around $1,000 to $2,000, in terms of cost, which is insane. I mean, that's like $20,000 to $40,000 in today's money. But he offered this real nice trophy. There was a huge ceremony, all this kind of stuff that went on there. So, it's safe to say that that $2,000 was probably based off of a number that was given by Bartlett Arkell. To be able to host the 1940 championship. So that was kind of not a good look. USGA didn't like that either. Jeff Sweetser, on behalf of the USGA, had recorded his dissatisfaction with that. And the committee had empowered him to go have a quote unquote frank talk with the NCAA Golf Committee. There was a suggestion that, hey, we've got the Western Junior Am is starting to play on college golf courses, so maybe that's a thing you should try to do. And about a month after they had that frank discussion, all of a sudden you get Ohio State, who had just opened up their course in 1940, in May of 1940, and hosted the Big Ten Championship that year. They are announced to host the 1941 championship. And that, I know that was a whole string of conversation there, but if you're still following along, that is in and of itself a big deal, not just because you've got the start of colleges that are hosting this championship tournament on their own courses, but it just so happens that the Ohio State women's athletic, or excuse me, not athletic, but physical education department was really pushing at that same time to try and get women's athletics going. They wanted their own women's NCAA, if you will. And there's a whole backstory as to why that wasn't already occurring. But the short version of that is that there was a de-emphasis on women's athletics, and they're trying to get women's golf going. And so because Ohio State was already hosting in 1941, and the physical education committee there had the blessing from the AD at the time, they were able to also start up women's college golf officially there at Ohio State the week after the men's championship in 1941. And that's where you have really the start of women's college golf going up from there.
Wow, that's
So,
fascinating.
really interesting set of circumstances that also nets us women's college golf,
Yeah,
which
that's
is really
crazy.
cool.
So basically, like what I'm gathering from it is before 1940, it was up to bidders, basically, people wanting to have the tournament at their golf course, or was that at the discretion still of the IGA or the NCAA?
Yeah, so it was more at the discretion of the let's say the USGA and
USGA.
then the NCAA. Yeah, but really it was golf courses stepping up and saying, yes, hey, we'll definitely host you for this or that, for the actual championship. And it was this backroom bidding that was really frowned upon. So that is actually not something that they were really encouraging. It was quite the opposite.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that it wasn't the NCAA being involved in women athletics. It was all done by Ohio State's physical education staff. That's a really cool little nugget.
Oh man, it's awesome. And there's a lot of stuff going on there. Some of the things that I've been writing on for my Substack is the men's championship. I did a whole series for that. Starting up a women's championship series here for this coming spring that's really going to dive into the history of that because it's obviously fascinating, but there's a lot of important stuff that happens that's really kicked off by the golf tournament specifically at that time. And frankly, there's just a lot of important things that goes along with that for women's athletics in general. So it's really cool that golf is sort of the basis for a lot of organized women's athletics that happens. And we're going to get into it with the series, but the NCAA actually litigated their way into taking women's athletics. They were not the good guys in this situation.
Oh, imagine that. All right. So that leads us up into World War II, I guess, right? So you get 1940, 1941, 1942 kind of starts World War II. What is the college golf scene look like during World War II? Are they even playing at this point in time?
Barely. Yeah, barely. It was not good. I mean, you've got the USGA and basically the rest of golf that in this country kind of shuts down. So that is one thing that the NCAA did for college golf was it actually kept it going through the war years. You've got all kinds of different rationings that are happening, including gas. And so you don't really have the funds for these schools to come together and meet up anywhere. So it for a couple of years there, it was down to just five teams, and it was basically a Big Ten championship. And again, Ohio State is kind of the one that helps keep that going, so that by the time we get to 1946, and players are coming back, you see quite a few players return and play on the same team that they were playing for before the start of the war, and kind of pick up where they left off, if you will, but then it really kind of explodes out from there. So World War II were really lean years, but I do want to touch on something really fast. So 2020, obviously, championship doesn't happen. This is the first time since World War I that you don't have a championship that occurs. So the 4 years that we did not get a college golf championship are 1900, 1916, or excuse me, 1917, 1918, and 2020. So over 125 years of history, there's only 4 years we haven't had a championship, and it just so happens that you were a part of that history as well, which is not a great honor, but is still pretty interesting.
It was, yeah, that was definitely an interesting year. I would take COVID over World War I for sure. I guess if we're picking, but yeah, that's crazy. So I guess from then we kind of have like a dead period, right? Where they're playing, it's kind of picking up, and then it seems like in 1960 things really start to take the shape that we see today in college golf. It says start of five, count four, aggregate at the end of the tournament, reduce field size. There's multiple changes in 65, but it seems like 1960 is the start of like what I think of as college golf. Is that a fair representation?
I think so. I know we're running up against the time limit here, so it's probably something we might want to save for a future episode if you'd have me on again.
Yeah.
But yeah, 1960, things had gotten really out of hand in terms of field size. I mean, we're talking upwards of 300 and 350 players that are in this. So it was a six count four event for quite some time. Some teams chose not to bring any more than four, but it was upwards of six count four. In 1960, you start seeing that push for let's reduce the field size a little bit. We're going to make it five count four. And you mentioned the word aggregate. That's important because it's done at the end of however many rounds that they're playing, whether it's two or four rounds. And that's when you determine your best four scores. So that's the first emphasis on reducing the field size. And then in 1965 is really a crucial hinge year because you've got the NCAA creates committees to start screening which teams are going to come in. So they set up districts. There's about eight districts that get set up. You have the top teams and individuals from those areas are invited to come play, and that was determined by the committee. And then you've also got the dropping of the individual match play, which was a big deal all the way prior to that. It was the individual match play is what determined your individual champion, and that happened after the team portion. Now what you get is your stroke play for everything. And at first you've got the first 36 holes of play are going to be for the team championship, and then the next 36 holes are going to be for your individual championship. And there's a bunch of changes that happen throughout that. That's a generalization, but yeah, 1965 is where you start really seeing the change towards what we're more used to today, as far as you've got a screening process. And then in 1978, you've got five count four at the end of each round rather than aggregate.
Okay. So I guess we start getting into regions then when you're talking districts. Are we talking like they're playing each tournament in their district, or the NCAA is going through each university at this point in time and figuring out which teams are better than the others, kind of starting to rank them a little bit and starting to invite them to their national tournament?
Yeah, definitely. Regionals themselves didn't get started until 1989. That's when we have regions that we're used to seeing it. It started out as three regions, your East, Central, West, and the districts kind of determined what region you were in. But prior to that, the districts themselves, like I said, somewhere around eight is going to be where you're going to have a NCAA committee member who's over that district and is kind of making that determination. Now that's in conjunction with the Golf Coaches Association, so it's not purely an NCAA thing, but there's a lot of correlation between what they were using at that time to kind of determine what to get in as what we're seeing now.
Yeah, so like what were they using at this point in time to like figure out which teams were good and which teams weren't?
I don't have a specific list of criteria, just from what has been written down and what I've been able to kind of put together, and understand is that, you know, it's a little bit of the eye test. It's a little bit of who's expected to be good. You know, it's not unlike the way that we start out ranking football teams to start the year, right? Or even, you know, golf teams, in general, we say, okay, well, we know that, you know, teams X, Y, and Z are going to be really good because they're always really good. Houston, for example, is always going to be really good at this time, so they're definitely going to be in unless, you know, something drastic happens. So it is more it's more of you know, looking to see who is supposed to be good and who fulfills that expectations versus having some formula or set criteria that way. That definitely comes into play later. And again, this is a big generalization for a large time frame, but yeah.
Is 65 around when the Golf Coaches Association has started, or has that been around at this point?
No, that's actually been around for a little while prior to that. So the 1950s is you see the start of the Golf Coaches Association, and that picks up with a lot of the coaches that are, you know, in the history books as far as their teams are winning championships or the individuals are winning championships. And it just kind of grows from there.
Gotcha. All right, man. Well, I think that's a good place to stop for part one. I'm definitely going to have you on as my next episode, and we're going to talk later college golf. like I said, I think this is maybe going to be a tough listen for people listening to me, not to you, because I don't really know what I'm talking about. You really do. I really appreciate all your input. That was fascinating. I knew nothing about any of this before talking to you. Michigan's a blue blood. Alabama's blue blood. And the IGA, WGA, and USGA were the homies back in the day. So thank you for coming on. I can't wait to have you on part two. And go ahead and shout out your Twitter and anything else you want to get out before part two.
Thanks again, Cannon. I really appreciate you letting me ramble on here. I hope people weren't too turned off of a history lesson. Maybe got a nice nap in at the very worst. But yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. C Golf Book is my handle, but College Golf Book is generally what you'll see me posting as. And then Five Count Four is the big thing that I'm trying to get going. So fivecountfour.substack.com is where you can find a lot of this information in written form.
Awesome, man. Well, again, I appreciate you coming on. I don't think people are going to be bored. I think you're going to have a lot of people that are interested in golf finding this to be very interesting, even though they had to listen to me talk for about an hour. So we're going to probably come back and do this either the next week or the week after. I'm really interested in getting into part two of this. So I appreciate your time, and I'm excited to talk to you again.
Thanks, Cannon. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Look forward to it as well.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.